Where we sit right now in the United States is the question of whether or not we really are going to try to embrace the idea of a multiracial, multigendered democracy.
What happened on January 6th just teaches us that the struggle for democratic freedom is never over.
If we cannot hold our leaders to account, that is a death blow to democracy.
That was a clip from the documentary Democracy Under Siege, which features our guests today. Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. Today we're talking about a documentary that's been getting a lot of attention. It's meeting the political moment as well as the artistic moment that we're in right now. It's called Democracy Under Siege, and we have the filmmaker here with us today. Laura Nix is the director of offbeat documentaries The Yes Men Are Revolting and Whether You Like It or Not, The Story of Hedwig. Her short film Walk, Run, Cha-Cha was nominated for a 2020 Academy Award, and she's been a film expert for the U.S. State Department's American Film Showcase. And we'll be joined a bit later in the program by celebrated political cartoonist Ann Telness, who plays a major role in Democracy Under Siege. Welcome to Words and Pictures, Laura.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start by talking a little bit about this documentary, Democracy Under Siege. Seems a little too on the nose right now.
Yes, I was approached about making a film for a Belgian production company. It's part of a series called Draw for Change, featuring women cartoonists from all over the world who are using their editorial cartooning work to comment on an issue that's important in their country. And I was asked to direct the American episode of this with the idea that the commissioning editors that I was speaking to in Europe wanted to have a documentary film that would explain the crisis in US democracy to a European audience, which is quite difficult because where do you begin? Where do you end? There's a lot of different things to be able to talk about. And my goal was to not just make a documentary film that would focus on Trump's second candidacy, but rather to really open up the topic to be able to look at issues that have been plaguing our democracy since the founding of the country.
So you lined up some respected political and legal minds for this film. Heather Cox Richardson, Ellie Mistel, Stephen Levitsky, Jamie Raskin. And it's strange to say, but they're very entertaining, the way that you present them. They offer quite the engaging backstory about the founders and the Constitution and American history.
Yes, it was very difficult to choose who to get to talk about these issues because they're quite dense. My job is to be able to kind of choose people who have inspired me. And I went out and read a ton of books to get my head around what were the most salient topics to include in the film. I was a history major. I also took a bunch of political science and international relations classes. But I found that in my research, there was a whole bunch of stuff I didn't know. And I learned a lot by making the film. There were certain things that I thought I had a handle on that proved to be much more wobbly information than I would have liked to have admitted. And I wanted to make sure that for a European audience, that we were able to talk about some of these systemic challenges that we've had because, you know, from the outset, I've been told always that I was growing up in the greatest democracy in the world and our constitution is the greatest in the world. And when you start digging deep and you start talking to some of these fabulous people that we had in the film, they tell a very different story about the challenges that we face and that we have faced from the beginning so that we could actually have the will of the majority be reflected in our political results.
Right. One thing you go into, and I don't know how many Americans know this, even those who passed the Constitution test, but there were a lot of compromises made by the founders in order to come to agreement on a Constitution. And a lot of those compromises benefited slaveholders. We're still living with that legacy.
Exactly. I think that the fact that political representation is based on land and not the number of people directly comes from the founding documents when there was the decisions made to be able to keep the union intact. The states in the South were threatening to bolt unless they were given a certain amount of power. And that meant that populations, lower population states were given senatorial representation so that it would be equal and they would not be, that they would have the interests of the slave states represented from a very early time. That's one of the reasons why it's so important that we keep teaching history and we have to keep an eye on the censorship of American history that's happening in certain states around the country. There's been a real push to not teach certain aspects of American history, especially as it relates to the disenfranchisement of large segments of the American population. And if we don't teach our history, we're not able to understand our present.
Sure, you've been making the film largely for a European audience who are dealing, the European Union right now is dealing with some governments that have fallen to authoritarianism or have struggled with it. And in the film, you talk about how one of the tools used by authoritarians to gain power is a mythologized past. And when the facts about our history are constantly attacked in the media and in the classroom, the fantasy version gets a leg up.
The person who spoke about that so eloquently in the film, historian Heather Cox Richardson, who I had the honor of interviewing, she speaks about what might be called natural laws. You can't see my air quotes, but I'm using air quotes there. And it's, when you're thinking about how authoritarians function, one of the promises that they make is to bring back some kind of ideal past, which is a fantasy. Which is a way of saying that things used to be better at a certain time. Things are always better for one segment of that population more so than the other. And it's a tactic to try and get people to believe that somehow there's a way to roll back history. In the US, that's always thinking about a time before 1965, right? Before we had the Voting Rights Act, which gave everybody truly the opportunity to vote. Before the passage of the Equal Employment Opportunity Act, which basically made discrimination in the workplace illegal, which, by the way, was just done away with by an executive order by President Trump. So it's looking at a moment in time when there was some assumptions made that men needed to be the ones in power, that white people would be in power, that women need to stay at home. That gay people would never exist, that there would be a kind of hiding of everyone that is outside what is perceived to be a kind of normative in US culture.
There's a lot of very serious subject matter in this film, but all throughout the film, you always keep a healthy sense of the absurd. There's a lot of outrage expressed, but also a lot of fun.
It's really important when you're talking about things like the three-fifths clause and Senate malapportionment and tyranny of the minority and all these things that you got to keep it light on some level. And that's why I was so lucky to be able to work with cartoonist Ann Telness because Ann's drawings are taking these really complex political and governmental issues that we have. And she just kind of like slices them right open and makes them very accessible to any audience member and does so with a great deal of humor. We were incredibly fortunate to be able to have access to Anne's library of cartoons that she's been doing for over 30 years. And we had not just images of current politicians that we're familiar with, but we're able to go back in time and think about how we can imagine conceptually and visually some of these thornier questions that we're facing. And it makes a huge difference in the watchability of the movie.
Well, on that note, let's play a clip from the documentary Democracy Under Siege.
People love looking at cartoons. I mean, if you have a whole page, let's just say a newspaper page, and you have various columns and you have a cartoon in there, people will automatically go to that first. I am very worried about American democracy. I honestly think that we're going to enter a bad phase. I just do. Just because I think that people don't realize, the average American doesn't realize how dangerous it is.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking about Democracy Under Siege. It's a documentary about press freedom, and our guest is the filmmaker Laura Nix. And now we're joined by a celebrated editorial cartoonist. She's won the Herblock Prize, the Rubin Award, and the Pulitzer Prize for her print cartoons. And with a background in animation, she's one of the rare political cartoonists whose drawings you can see move. Anne Telnes, great to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
So, Anne, the film, Democracy Under Siege, begins with a quote from you as you're working in your studio. You say that images are so powerful because they don't rely on words. They transcend language. They also transcend class.
Right. Yeah. I think it's sort of a given that images are powerful in the sense that everybody likes looking at them. But I also think they bring it down on a level. You know, I mean, it really doesn't matter what class you're in or how much money you have or whatever. Everyone can be affected by them. I mean, as we know, authoritarians have a very bad sense of humor, and editorial cartoons can really get under their skin. So I think that's kind of a powerful part of editorial cartooning that we don't necessarily think about, but it really does affect every human being, regardless of class.
Yeah, I mean, now we have wealthy publishers taking over newspapers and openly firing cartoonists because their views don't align.
Sometimes it's not as cut and dry as firing. Sometimes it's kind of driving them out just because, you know, they get a muzzle on them. A lot of my colleagues have throughout the years been told, we don't want you doing cartoons on that person. You know, if you want to keep your job and your livelihood, then you kind of do that. So, you know, there's lots of different ways of shutting a cartoonist up. I mean, my colleagues overseas, you know, they have to deal with some pretty awful situations. I mean, in the sense that, you know, they can be thrown in jail for what they say against their leadership. They have been attacked by thugs that are employed by the leadership. But in this country, it's a little bit more subtle, at least at this point. we have, you know, corporations that, you know, will pressure publishers and editors to do a certain thing. And, you know, cartoonists are sort of at the end of it.
Well, you've been a political cartoonist for well over 20 years, some 16 of those working for The Washington Post. What was your first reaction when Laura approached you with this documentary idea?
Oh, wow. Laura and I go back. This has been in the works for a long time. You know, I don't know how Laura felt, but I felt really comfortable speaking with Laura right away. I mean, she's really approachable and she's so smart and she's so creative. So I just enjoyed chatting with her in the beginning, but we went through so many different twists and turns with this documentary that it almost became comical after a while. I mean, we laugh about it now, but you know, there were some tough times there. But yeah, I'm really glad that we finally got a chance to work together because it was a lot of talk in the beginning, and now we actually have a documentary, which I have to say, all the praise should go to Laura, because Laura has done an amazing job with what she was given, time constraints and everything. And I mean, I have to say, I learned a lot from this documentary. I mean, I was just part of it as someone who gave the cartoons and, you know, talked a little bit on camera. But, you know, I've watched it a few times. I've given it to friends to watch. I say, watch this, because you will learn a lot about your own country and how voting works. And I did. I certainly did. Yeah, all the credit should go to Laura.
That's very kind of you, Anne. I would say the opposite, because if I find that it's watchable because of your great cartoons. Otherwise, you might feel like you're just in a history lesson. But, you know, we can talk about how it originally started, which was we were going to be making a film about the Supreme Court and specifically about the role that the FBI plays in confirming or doing investigations on Supreme Court justices before they're confirmed. And we were looking at what happened with the confirmation specifically of Clarence Thomas and the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. And it was interesting from the kind of perspective of the Me Too movement, which is what they originally approached me with. They wanted a film about the Me Too movement. And I thought that was a really interesting topic to make a documentary about and decided to focus it on those two confirmation processes. But it ended up that it was just too specific for Europeans. And so they asked if we would do something more broad. And that was decided on in January of 2024. So we had, I want to say, like 7 to 8 months to make the entire film from beginning to end. So it ended up going very fast, even though we were in conversation and developing the Supreme Court film for several years.
Yeah, Laura, you were talking about the Supreme Court, and you have Congressmember Jamie Raskin in the film talking about the recent corruption of the Supreme Court. He says that, instead of being interested in civil rights, so many of the justices are interested now in expanding corporate power and giving corporations whatever they want. And his quote is, "So every corporate treasury in America has been transformed into a political piggy bank and slush fund for every CEO in America."
We had a whole section about Citizens United, which is the Supreme Court case that decided that corporations were people and could have corporate voice and therefore could be represented financially in elections. And like many topics that we had to cut out from the film, or else it would have been, a 10-hour series, that was one of the ones that went by the wayside. But that's really what Representative Raskin is talking about, is the effect that Citizens United had on Supreme Court decisions. And again, I don't think that that is something that a lot of other Supreme Courts in other parts of the world, or at least in what's considered modern democracies, are facing. And it's one of the times that we have to step back and compare the way that our high court functions in relation to other countries' high courts. They don't have, we're the only democracy in the world that has Supreme Court justices with lifetime tenure. We're the only Supreme Court in the world that has no ethics policy for its Supreme Court justices, which allows this kind of personal enrichment of some of the justices to take place. They're not all doing it, but some of them have been receiving a lot of money from private individuals who have business before the court. And there's nothing there to push back about that, because they've decided that, they passed recently like a kind of code, an ethics code for themselves, but it's non-binding. Other justices in the United States, other judges in the United States don't have the same rules even applied to them. So why is the most powerful court being given that leeway? It's one of the questions that are asked in the film, and Anne's drawings do a great job of showing the difference in between the power of these justices and others. But yeah, the Supreme Court is, it took a long time, I think, for some people to understand the breadth of the power that the Supreme Court has. And it was only after this particular court really got in place during Trump's first presidency and was able to transform it completely. And now we're living the reality of what some of those changes are. Obviously overturning Roe v. Wade is one of those. And the one that I think that happened towards the end of Biden's term with giving immunity to presidents is basically like giving an automatic pardon to Trump for whatever he wants to do. And the ramifications of that are going to drastically change executive power in this country for perhaps decades to come. And we're going to be living the results of that.
Right. And like Laura said, you do a lot of cartoons about the Supreme Court, especially since the first Trump term. And it's pointed out that this is the first time that we have the Supreme Court actually taking away established rights. You have a speech where you're accepting the Herblock Award for editorial cartooning, and you warn the crowd about intolerance and the danger, I'm quoting here, of people looking to impose their beliefs on others, limiting speech and expression, and the right to make decisions about your own personal life.
Kind of sounds like the Supreme Court, huh? Yeah, I actually did cartoons about the Supreme Court even before the Trump administration. But now when I look back, I just think, boy, that was a pretty tame Supreme Court with Scalia and Rehnquist to what we have now. Yeah, it's really amazing. I'm glad that Laura mentioned the immunity decision, because not only does that shield him from any accountability to all these cases that have been against him, I also think it kind of led to his winning the presidency, because he was never brought really to justice. He had one trial, the New York one, result in him being convicted. But, that took so long, and then it finally came around that he was sentenced, but it was such a
meaningless sentence that nobody really cared. So people were going to the polls and not realizing that, you know, here we have a convicted felon, or they didn't care. But I really think it just sort of kind of made the ability for him to win the election. You know, it just kind of opened up things. So I don't think we're done. You know, I mean, obviously Roe versus Wade being overturned is one thing, but, you know, we're not done because unfortunately, in the next 4 years, we're probably going to have another slot open on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, which they'll probably put in a very young person again to that. And they made it really clear when you read the ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade, which is the Dobbs decision, it's very clear that they might be going after gay marriage, and they also might be going after birth control, you know, with the Comstock Act. So I think that we are at the beginning of understanding the power that this institution holds and the impact that it could have on almost every aspect of American life.
Yes, and Anne, in the film, you talk about how the media was not used to a candidate who just blatantly lies. They didn't know how to deal with the rise of Trump and right-wing outlets because they were holding on to standards that prevented them from using the word lie.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember very well early in the Trump administration that I could not use the word lie. I could not write it in any of my cartoons for the longest time. And it was really just to the end of his administration where I could finally write lie. The press did a horrendous job going into the 2016 election. They really treated Trump as a joke. They saw him as entertainment. They saw him as getting, you know, eyeballs on, you know, their coverage. And they finally, I think, realized toward the end of it that it was dangerous. But they seem to have forgotten that again coming into the second one. I don't know if it's fear or if it's still a quest for, you know, the numbers or what. But for some reason, they are doing about as bad a job this time, just in a different way than they did last time. So this has been, you know, something I've cartooned about for a long time. I'll continue to do that because I think, you know, you have to have a vigorous press, a vigorous free press in order to make sure that all these things that the administration is doing is coming to light. And if they don't cover it, no one will know about it. So I don't think I'm with Laura. I'm not incredibly optimistic for the next 4 years.
Well, Laura, your film spotlights some overlooked moments in recent history. And one of the things that's kind of forgotten is back around 1995, House Speaker Newt Gingrich helped push through deregulation of the media. You know, Rupert Murdoch lobbied him for a waiver of the FCC rules that had always restricted foreign ownership of the media. And that, of course, led to Fox News and opened the door to foreign influence in the U.S. election process.
Yeah, I think it was when there was a time when the media landscape went through a huge shift when there were channels like Fox News that began that were basically used as a pulpit for kind of a far right view. Then now you can add Newsmax to that. You can add OAN to that. But right now it's on an order of magnitude different yet again. You know, when we speak about media, what are we talking about? Are we talking about legacy media? Are we talking about broadcast stations or established newspapers? Or are we talking about podcasts? You know, like the kind of importance that like Joe Rogan has, or the kind of importance of things like media blogs that kind of masquerade as channels like The Late InfoWars by Alex Jones. And the tons and tons of influencers on different channels, people spreading information, a lot of disinformation and misinformation on social media. Social media has completely turned the news inside out and the press inside out. And we're still, I don't think that our elections have caught up yet with the impact that media has made. I personally don't believe that Americans made informed decisions even in the last election.
And to just add to that, all the different varying outlets that people can access or not, you also have a mainstream media that doesn't really report on the news. They're doing more entertainment news, you know, and that's a big problem because some people just get it from there. So if you don't have the Walter Cronkites giving you the news, it's open to all different kinds of things. Social media being a big problem here is people will share stories, you know, between friends and family, and there's no following up. They will just pass it along. I taught a college class a couple of years ago, and I was completely taken aback and surprised that how many of my students, when asked to bring in articles to discuss at each class, because everybody had that as a project, would bring in stuff that they just got through their social media feed. And I made a rule. I told them, I said, you got to bring me a second source. You can't bring me just that one link. You got to go back and see if anyone else is reporting on that. So I think that is probably a really big problem still.
Yeah, you've got propaganda outlets now that are well-funded, like OAN and Newsmax and Breitbart. And you have Trump advisor Steve Bannon talking about that fire hose of propaganda and comparing it, quote, to flooding the zone with shit.
I think that we're living in a media overwhelm, right? We're just completely and totally saturated with every single kind of information. And you have to be able to go out and find number of sources. I mean, when we finished the film, we had fact checkers come in, and every single thing that every single person said, we had to show that it was backed up by three sources outside. And that's not how people are receiving information, right? I mean, if you're on social media, if you're watching TikTok, if you're getting your politics from TikTok, right? I'm not saying that everybody on TikTok is bad, right? There's a lot of people who are doing and sharing journalistic work on TikTok. It's not the medium itself. It's the investigation behind that media. And what is the work and what is the fact checking that's going into the media that is then shared? And unfortunately, I mean, the opinion taking over, Ann talked a little bit about how it's entertainment news. But the other thing that I would say that is, it really strikes me is how much a lot of the news has just become sharing of opinion. And there's many times when I want to follow what's going on in the world, and I have to turn to something outside the country to be able to understand what's happening. I listen to the BBC, for instance, to understand what the news is, because if I turn to a channel, whether it's MSNBC or even, you know, something like CNN, there's people sharing their take, their hot take on what's going on, but I'm not necessarily understanding what happened that day. I think that we do have to become better at choosing our news sources and making sure that they're varied and making sure that we're listening to different opinions. I mean, I watch Fox News because I want to understand what people are saying who have a different viewpoint than myself.
I think that's interesting what Laura just said about that she feels like she has to read a bunch of different stuff to get the news. Because, I mean, I'm an opinion person. I mean, my editorial cartoons are supposed to give an opinion. But I have found in the last, well, during the Trump administration, sometimes I would get so frustrated with not being able to get facts and news that I would purposely do a cartoon where I would go back and find quotes. So I'm not putting an opinion there. I'm using quotes of what this person is saying. I remember specifically this one that I did during COVID when Trump was, you know, changing his tone the whole time, and at the end saying, oh, you know, everything is fine, don't worry. And I purposely went through and picked like about eight different quotes and put them in the cartoon. I mean, I had to be checked by my editors to make sure that those were correct, but I did that for a reason. I wanted people to see exactly what he said, and I put the date under each one of them so they could follow the progression of when he said, oh, it's just going to blow over, oh, it's fine, don't worry about it, we're great, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's China's fault. But, you know, that's not usually the way a cartoon is put together, you know, but I felt the need to do that. And once in a while I do that where I just will pull out quotes just to kind of use people's words to show the readers the facts.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking about the documentary Democracy Under Siege. Our guests are filmmaker Laura Nix and political cartoonist Ann Telness. Well, Ann, you've said that editorial cartoons are part journalism and aren't always funny. And a few years ago, you taught a course at your alma mater, CalArts, California Institute of the Arts. It was called Commentary Through Cartoons. What was that like? You were, teaching civics lessons to animators?
Well, that wasn't my intention. That's where I went to school, where I learned how to be an animator, actually, before I even considered becoming an editorial cartoonist. And it was just a once a week class. It was actually great in a couple of ways. One, it kind of made me feel hopeful because my students were very engaged, which I was not at that age. I wasn't even reading a newspaper at that age, but they were very engaged. And, you know, they did some really great stuff, I have to say, and they loved discussing things. But I discovered, and it's not just college kids that were having this problem, frankly, it was every voter, you know, all the way up to age 80, that they just really didn't know how to read the news critically. So that ended up being part of my course, where we actually talked a lot about that and why that was important. So that was an eye-opener. Actually, I think every single American should take a class about how to read the news critically. I think that would save us a lot of trouble. But it was a good experience, frankly.
And shortly after this film was completed, you had a very public breakup with the Washington Post.
Yes, I did. It wasn't planned. I mean, just to kind of give you a general thing of what happened is I've been an editorial cartoonist for a long time. I have had editors, and, you know, editors, they play an important part. Sometimes they save you from yourself. I've had that happen a couple of times. But in this case, this particular editor decided to not okay a rough that I had done that included Jeff Bezos in it. And I had never had a cartoon just rejected by this or any other editor just because of the subject matter. Now, I've had a lot of cartoons edited because of there's an image in it that they feel is problematic, that might be misinterpreted or wasn't a good fit at the moment. You know, during the Charlottesville killing of that unfortunate young woman, I did a cartoon that another editor said, no, we're not doing that now. And I could understand that because tensions were high and he just didn't want to inflame them. But this was a different situation. This was a situation where I wasn't given a reason at first. It was just like, no, we're not doing it. And of course, after all that, it came out that he claimed it was repetitive, which is a problematic explanation, to say the very least, and gave some other reasons why it wasn't, which of course were never brought up to me. It was just, no, don't, you're not going to do that subject matter. So, you know, as any other editorial cartoonist has to decide for themselves, you know, where their line is. And I knew immediately. I didn't even really think about it. I just thought, this is it. I can't do this anymore. I can't do my best work. I try to work with editors to make them comfortable with what I'm doing. But, you know, to be told that you can't touch a subject matter is a different thing.
So for our listeners who haven't seen this cartoon, the cartoon that never actually ran in the Washington Post, it depicts not just Jeff Bezos, but also other billionaires. And they're bowing down before an idol of Donald Trump, offering bags of money for his inauguration. And in the film, in Democracy Under Siege, your colleague Matt Werker makes an appearance. Matt is a political cartoonist for Politico. He calls the decision to kill the cartoon spineless, and he name-checked two legendary figures from the glory days of the Washington Post, editor Ben Bradley and cartoonist Herb Block, saying they were spinning, kicking, and screaming in their graves.
Yes, he said that, right. And I think it was in the New York Times piece, I believe he said that in response to the editorial page editor's comment. Yeah, I tend to agree with him. I think that I'm sure Herb Block would have not stood for it. I think, unfortunately, it is a result of editorial page editors not necessarily knowing what the purpose of an editorial cartoon is. You know, the cartoon part is always instantly recognizable by people. And, you know, they always think it's supposed to be funny. I can guarantee you I'm not very funny. It's supposed to have a point of view. And sometimes they can cut to the core sometimes, you know, they can be hard hitting. But that's what makes the difference between an editorial cartoon and a regular one. And that's why we're considered part of journalism, even though not a lot of people know that either, editors included.
I was just going to say that I think that it's so important to think about Anne leaving the Washington Post after them refusing to run this particular cartoon, which is not just Jeff Bezos, but Mickey Mouse and the editor of the LA Times and a couple of other people, Zuckerberg included, Musk was in there as well, who were prostrating themselves at the foot of the president and basically not listening to Timothy Snyder. If you haven't read that book on tyranny by Timothy Snyder, I think rule number two is like, do not obey in advance, right? And we saw the LA Times and the Washington Post obey in advance when they refused to give their endorsements of Kamala Harris.
The endorsements had already been written and the publishers killed them.
And the publishers killed those endorsements. And why is that? It's because all of those folks have business before the government and they wanted to be in good graces with who they perceived might win the election. And I think that we're seeing a lot of people obey in advance and kowtow to these kind of autocratic figures before the election and after the election. I mean, when I was finishing the film back in August of 24, Musk wasn't playing the same role yet. I mean, he was kind of flirting around the edges, but he had not become this really important figure in the Trump campaign yet. It's incredible sometimes to remember how fast these things shift, right? He was around, but he was not playing the kind of role that he did. And it definitely had not come to light that he had spent $250 million on Trump's campaign, including $100 million for that Progress 2028, which turned out to be pretty important in the end. So I think that I didn't know that Anne was going to quit the Washington Post. And I remember seeing the news announcement and I wrote to her and I was like, good for you. I'm so proud of you because you are speaking truth to power right now. And I'm really worried about what might happen next in terms of how, especially legacy media, is going to hold this administration accountable for its actions and tell the truth about what's going on and its effect on the American people and whether or not we're going to be considered still a country that has laws that people are going to follow.
Yeah, one good thing is that other artists and writers have come out of the woodwork to support your courage, Anne. Fellow cartoonists took your preliminary sketch and worked up their own spin on it, their own versions.
They did, and they're better than mine. They're really great.
Yeah. It seems to me that in censoring you, the Post walked into that classic blunder, the Streisand effect, named after the incident where Barbara Streisand tried to suppress a photograph of her Malibu mansion, which only bolstered interest in it.
Right. Yeah. Almost like on steroids, that one. Yeah. I'm being honest. I really did not expect this reaction at all. The reason I wrote my Substack post, you know, why I decided to quit the Washington Post was because I wanted to explain myself to my readership because I would just be gone, you know, from the page after all these years. I mean, it's not like the Post is going to let you write anything about why you're leaving. And I wanted to also explain to my colleagues because, you know, this is for American editorial cartoonists, this is the top position that you could possibly get as the Washington Post. This is where the legendary Herbach worked for so many years, you know, and I was there a long time. It was a great place to show your work and get reaction. But, you know, I just didn't feel like I could go on. I just knew deep down inside, I think every editorial cartoonist knows when they're being, I don't know if censored is the right word, but you censor yourself almost, you know, because you're adjusting your work to fit what your employer wants. And that's not a good thing. And, you know, for someone like me that chose to go into this field, I mean, as I mentioned, I was in animation, but I had things happen in my life where I thought I really want to say something with my artwork. And that's why I chose this. It certainly wasn't for the pay. It was a lot of work and a lot of years. There wasn't a lot of money to be made, but I just, to find an art form that you could actually speak through was wonderful for me. I mean, I needed it. You know, Laura mentioned the whole thing about the Supreme Court, the two confirmation processes of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. That is the reason that I decided to become an editorial cartoonist, was I watched those hearings as a young woman. I had dealt with sexual harassment in my own career, and I just decided, this is it. I'm going to make some comments here through my work. So, you know, this was, everything was sort of a gut feeling for me. So quitting was also sort of like, I can't go on doing this.
Well, Laura, this film that you've directed is part of a series called Draw for Change. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, each episode is from the point of view of a director and a cartoonist from a country, and it's highlighting the points of view of women cartoonists in each place. And so there are episodes from Egypt, from Syria, from Russia, from Mexico. They're all produced out of Belgium, but each one is looking at what that cartoonist and director thinks is the most important issue for women in that country. And it turns out for our film, this issue of democracy is the most important thing for Americans to be thinking about right now.
You know, we don't have yet that level of political oppression that you see in places like Egypt or Syria, but still what's happening in the newspapers, I was noticing that in the wake of Ann stepping down, the Washington Post is running editorial cartoons that are indistinguishable from New Yorker cartoons. And, you know, I'm thinking political cartoons are harder to find in the U.S. than ever before, despite the fact that people love them and look for them.
We've had this issue even before the Trump administration. You know, the problem is when subscribers get angry at a political cartoon, then, you know, they threaten to stop their subscription. And that has an effect on publishers, obviously, and newspaper owners. So that is probably part of the problem, too, is that, you know, throughout the years, I mean, even when I started in, my first published cartoon was in 1992. And I remember a lot of my colleagues at the time complaining that their editor wanted them to kind of tone it down a little bit because they were losing readership. And it's always been that problem. I think part of the problem is that people don't necessarily know what editorial cartoons are supposed to do, you know, and if the editor doesn't stand up for them, then that's your first line of defense. The editor has to support what you do and explain it. There have been plenty of them that do that, but then, you know, more and more are not now.
And I think that this is concurrent with what we're seeing in other art forms right now, which is there is a resistance to showing political work and political work that is critical of certain people or certain actions. I think that we, at least in the documentary field, we're seeing for the past several years now, actually, as the country's become more polarized, a lack of interest in programming or acquiring or commissioning documentaries within the United States that are political, because it is likely that it's going to offend somebody. So most of the time, they're making decisions to choose content which might be celebrity documentaries or true crime or something on sports or food, but something that's really middle of the road politically that won't ruffle any feathers anywhere, because they don't want to face any kind of blowback from either side about anything that would engage any topics politically. And that's coming at a time when we need to be having more conversation than ever before about these political issues. And even if that does include conflict between both sides on any issue, we have to hear that conversation as well. So instead, it's happening kind of in social media and kind of siloed rather than happening through film, through documentary film. And you talk about how people don't know what editorial cartooning is. My joke is that I don't think anybody knows what a documentary film is either, because a lot of people believe that documentary film is meant to be like journalism and should be objective. Most people who do journalism know that it is subjective, but documentary film is very subjective as well. And it's the point of view of the filmmaker on any given topic and making choices about what kind of points of view you want to share with your audience. And that's certainly what Democracy Under Siege is. And I think it's really important that we have access to this type of work right now, because we need to get people engaged in what these issues are. And there's also increasingly, I think, more interest in avoiding the news at this moment because people perceive the news to be depressing and too much and too stimulating. And so they're kind of disengaging from the news in a time when we really need people to be more engaged than ever.
Mickey Mouse makes an appearance in that censored cartoon that didn't make it into the Washington Post. And that, I believe, represented the Disney Corporation who handed $15 million to Trump to settle a suit with ABC News. There's a bit of irony in this. You started out as a character animator, and you fairly quickly got a gig with Walt Disney Imagineering. For me, that always brings to mind those folks who dream up mechanical marvels like theme park rides.
Yeah, we come up with concepts. I was, most of the stuff I came up with was never built. I did a lot of blue sky, as they called it. All my sketches are probably deep down in their dungeon archives. It was a great experience. I worked there for, well, I started out as a character animator, you're right. I did a little bit of animating as a freelancer. And then I decided to take the offer from Walt Disney Imagineering as a show designer because I really do enjoy designing probably more than animating. So yeah, I worked there for 6 years. It was a great experience. Lots of talented people there. But yeah, I thought it was kind of funny when I did that rough that I had two of my now former employers in the cartoon that got killed.
Well, you're still an animator, and it's rare for a political cartoonist to animate their drawings. I mean, there's Mark Fiore and more recently Sparaboom, but it really has to be a challenge to get a timely message out there that has more than just a single one-panel drawing.
Oh, yeah. And when I decided I was going to try to do an animated editorial cartoon, that's what I wanted to accomplish. I mean, you know, a print editorial cartoon, it's one image. You have to grab someone. People have to know exactly what your message is right away. And when I wanted to animate them, I just didn't want to do an animated piece, but I wanted to actually lead your eye the way you would lead it in print. And it had to be fast, and mine were very short. And of course, as you well know, being an animator yourself, to have some knowledge of it helps a lot. So I didn't go into it not knowing how to animate. I didn't have to learn how to animate. I was a little rusty. I had to like practice again. But yeah, I had that skill behind me, so then I could kind of translate it into an editorial cartoon. And the thing about editorial cartooning is sometimes certain mediums work better than others. You know, not all editorial cartoons need to be animated, but sometimes they have more of a punch when they're animated. It just depends on the subject matter. So that's kind of how I approach, you know, my own work.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking about the documentary Democracy Under Siege. Our guests are filmmaker Laura Nix and political cartoonist Ann Telness. Laura, we mentioned that you've been a film expert for the U.S. State Department's American Film Showcase. I suppose we don't yet know whether that situation has changed under Marco Rubio.
You know, I will just say this about the U.S. State Department. I've been a film envoy. I'm a film expert for them for several years now. And I learned so much about what the State Department does because I've been able to travel with the U.S. State Department to many countries around the world. I had no idea how much soft diplomacy goes on around the world and how much really thoughtful, smart work goes into American programs all over the world. You know, they just recently took apart USAID. That was one of the things that happened in the last week, which is terrifying. And I don't know yet what they're going to do to the Foreign Service and what they're going to do within the State Department. There was a huge whittling down in the first Trump administration, and I imagine the same thing to happen this time. But soft power goes a long way. And I think that having artists and musicians and experts, you know, go all over the world and be inside communities so people can meet Americans and talk to Americans and hear about work that Americans are making, whether they're novelists or economists or chefs. You know, these are all people who go all over the world with the U.S. State Department. It makes a difference. And I'm really proud to be a part of that program. They're also very liberal with us in the sense that, you know, we say, hey, are we supposed to like walk into a room and say that we agree with like American governmental like actions and policies? Because there's been times when I absolutely cannot do that. And if I'm sitting in a room of people, I'm going to be honest about the fact that I don't agree with like what the policy of the current administration is. And I will say it in public. And they say, yes, you are a private citizen and you are allowed to do that. So I have done that in many countries where they don't have the same kind of freedom of speech that I do at home. And I say that I feel like I'm lucky to be able to articulate those positions. My government allows me to do that. I'm a guest of this government and it's allowing me to speak as a private citizen at this moment. And I think it's important that we don't take things like that for granted. You know, I've been lucky enough to travel in many parts of the world where that does not exist. And I know how much that right means. And it's very easy to take certain things for granted about our democracy, that being one of them. And this is a time when we have to really ask ourselves what we value and how we want to hold on to it.
Well, Laura, you collaborated on this film with Hanna Flippo, who's doing this series on Drawing for Change. And Hanna is a firm believer in tackling social and political issues, but also working with creative people and talking about creative subjects and thinking of documentaries as advocacy. And you've done some political documentaries that are very entertaining and funny, actually. I'm thinking of, for example, The Yes Men Are Revolting. That was a profile of a couple of very bold culture-jamming pranksters.
Yeah, I believe in what I call the Trojan horse approach to dealing with issues, where I try and figure out, you know, there's things I care about that I'd really like to engage audiences about, but sometimes those are perceived as kind of eat your vegetable movies, and nobody wants to spend their time after work watching a film about something political that might seem boring. So I think you have to kind of take political issues and wrap them in something else to be able to get them through the door. And then all of a sudden somebody is watching a film about a political issue, but they're also involved in a story. So I think if you're doing character-based stories, or if you're using humor, or if you're using brilliant cartoons like Anne's, it's a way of people being inside a series of ideas and actually enjoying themselves thinking about those ideas, but you don't clobber people on the head with it. You know, you kind of come in through the side door through another way of thinking about these things. And I think that's true for The Yes Men Are Revolting. It's true for a film I did called Inventing Tomorrow about, it's an environmental film essentially, but it's also about kids going to a science fair from all over the world and watching these young people have this kind of mind-blowing experience. And that's the wrapper. That's how you get people to watch an hour and a half environmental documentary. And in this case, we got to use cartoons and we got to use humor to talk about these really thorny issues, like why can't we amend our constitution the way that other countries do? You know, why is it that Norway has amended its constitution over 300 times, you know, and we can barely get, you know, we can't even get the ERA passed in this country. Like, we have some really big systemic roadblocks to be able to have the majority will take place in our country. And it's a bit thorny. It could be perceived as being too granular or boring, but I'm a believer that in a kind of Schoolhouse Rock kind of way, that there's always a way to get people engaged in something that, you know, they might not choose. It might not be the first thing that they think they want to watch at night, but if you can make something entertaining and engaging, you can get people to think about anything.
So for people who are unfamiliar, the two yes men in The Yes Men Are Revolting, this is Andy and Mike. They do a very convincing job of impersonating public relations guys for government agencies and corporations. And they completely fool these rooms of reporters and business people, just making some really outrageous pronouncements.
Yeah, the point of the Yes Men is to give the media an excuse to cover topics that they normally can't. There's no room for them to be able to cover. So they might pretend to be executives from Dow Chemical. They might pretend to be executives from the DC Chamber of Commerce. And it's using, it's kind of media hijacking so that that topic is all of a sudden covered on the news based on the hijinks that they just put forward. And guess what? All of a sudden, like, people are listening to the media cover an issue that they were not going to cover that day.
Well, Laura, the documentary is out and world events keep happening. What's going on right now for you?
Well, we're getting ready to release Democracy Under Siege in the U.S., which will be really exciting to finally make it available to U.S. audiences, because it's been really interesting to see the reaction of European audiences. But it was made about my own country, and I am really interested to engage Americans on these topics. So that will be exciting. And we're talking about a potential follow-up film with the same commissioners who created this one, and we'll see whether or not that happens, but I'm very excited about being able to explore some of these further. This is going to be a long haul, so I think there's a lot of different ways to think about how we got here and how can we exit this predicament that we're in.
And let's see, you're in Santa Barbara right now.
Yeah, it's been great to share the film at the Santa Barbara Film Festival. We're super excited about being programmed here. And like I said, it's very interesting to hear what Americans have to say about the film. You know, I made the film before the election, and we are working on trying to give some kind of an update coda to the film that would be part of the U.S. release. But the film that we're showing in Santa Barbara is before the election. So I finished it in August, like late, I would say we picture locked in August. So before the election, and we also showed it in Europe before the election, before November 7th. So it's just astonishing to think about how many things have happened since then. I mean, this isn't a matter of years, this is a matter of months, and the country feels like it's already been turned upside down and inside out. And I have a feeling that it will continue to feel like this as we move forward. So the trick is to not get too distracted by the antics, I think, but really look at like what policies are changing, what laws are changing, what are things that we accept to be precepts of American democracy and American culture that are being changed by this administration, and encourage a lot of constructive dialogue around what people's feelings and beliefs are around those changes. I think it's more important than ever to be engaged with what's going on, and to also look towards what's going on in your own community to be able to make your community stronger.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and we've been talking today about the documentary Democracy Under Siege. Our guests have been filmmaker Laura Nix and political cartoonist Ann Telnis. Ann, Laura, great to have you on the show.
Thank you
so much for this conversation. It's been great.
Yeah.
Ann, we mentioned that you're no longer at the Washington Post. Where's a good place to see your cartoons?
On Substack is basically where I am right now. So yeah, head over there, and I have a Substack called Open Windows.
And for anyone who's interested in Laura's film, you can go to feltfilms.com or drawforchangetheseries.com. Democracy Under Siege is episode number 6. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture. Thank you.